Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends, and welcome to the World Transform. Program is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At the World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this astounding future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Man, I am doing great. Excited about another great show. Made it to the middle of the week, huh?
We have made it to hump day, and we are going to take on the big one, right? The Every now and then we talk about scary topics, but there's no scarier topic than the end of the world. But we thought we'd soften that a little with a trip to Mars. So we called this show End of the World. That's okay. Let's go to Mars, or words to that effect. And that's what we're going to talk about. So we've got a few topics related to the end of the world, kind of an odd mix of end of the world topics. And then we're going to pivot and talk a little bit about Mars. And as you see, if you stay with us, these two subjects are going to come together in a most unexpected and wonderful way. Am I overselling, Stephen, or do you think it's going to be unexpected?
we want to always over-deliver, don't we, Phil? I think we can do what we're what we're talking about here. So let's get to it. I think we can deliver.
Well, let's start off with one of the heroic efforts to keep us from having the world end. Interesting story in Tech Republic, how virtual reality can save humanity. And there is an argument that goes that a society is losing its humanity, but a powerful storytelling tool like VR can help revive it. So when we talk about saving humanity, we're not talking about biologically the species coming to an end, but rather just kind of the potential end of society. And I have to say,
we talk almost a spiritual salvation here, because, you know, I think that there's a point to be made here that technology has largely isolated us in the last few years. Bill, I mean, there's, a person could literally, go and rent an apartment and never leave, right? Because, you could do all your work you need to do from home. You could watch movies from home, have your food delivered. You could literally never leave if that's the life you wanted to live. And there's something about the modern world that tends to isolate us. And so he's saying, hey, maybe we'll get past that with the next level of technology. So what is he talking about with this VR?
Absolutely, that's true. And I can see where VR would have a kind of a strong potential antidote, right, to the isolation of technology, to exactly what you said. If everyone's stuck in their apartment, now we can actually be in the same space as each other again, right, without having to go anywhere. Yeah. So it solves the problem from that perspective. But the other thing going on is that this first wave of social technology that we've experienced over the last decade or so has had a really unexpected effect on how we interact with each other, something I never anticipated, because we always talk about how technology has connected us, and it has. It allows us to communicate with each other, and it's allowed us to meet each other and, to form affiliations and so forth. But it's also become a vastly effective tool at dividing us up. Social technology has helped create ideological tribes, reinforce them and make them more ideological and make them more opposed to each other, I think, than they were before. And what this story is saying is that virtual reality not only connects us in a common space, but it also provides this storytelling metaphor. If PJ Manny were here, she would talk about the importance of telling stories in terms of helping humans to build empathy with each other. And then this is kind of what's been lacking in this first wave of social technology. So what we're seeing here is real hope for a technology that's going to enable us to develop empathy for one another, to reclaim that, to find that. I think we were maybe a little better at empathy before social technology came along, sadly enough. And this may be the technology boost from virtual reality that pushes us back in the right direction. At least that's the point of the story that we've linked here. And there are good reasons to think that virtual reality will be the most effective storytelling medium ever. They talk about, you know, ability to suspend disbelief, an ability to have audiences completely captive into a place. You can be brought into an experience in a way you never have before. And if you can be brought into the experiences of others, that's where empathy will begin. So a lot of potential abuse for virtual reality, but I like the idea that maybe we're seeing VR as a uniquely capable technology for bringing people together. So,
well, and, you know, I have seen on Facebook a picture that's, you know, it's kind of something's going around on Facebook. It shows this poor grandmother sitting there on a couch, surrounded by her entire family, and every single person in the picture is on their cell phone.
Right.
She's trying to visit with her family, and like literally nobody's paying her any attention. And the caption is, you know, put down the cell phone and visit with grandma. She may not always be there, and you know, it's sad, but that's, I think there's been some, you know, some instances of that. VR would allow us to communicate with a grandmother wherever she, you know, wherever you are. You could, you know, could be walking down the halls of your school or office or whatever, and grandmother could be right there with you having a conversation if you chose. But also, I mean, even more, I mean, VR could even allow us to walk in the shoes of other people, right? I mean,
that's exactly right. Yes.
If you could, you know, understand what it's like to be a refugee in some countries far away, you know, maybe you would have a, and you get to experience that just a little bit with something like VR, then, you know, perhaps we could do things to be a little more proactive in helping people like that. So, yeah, and or in the case of the grandmother, maybe you could walk a mile in her shoes, too, and realize, hey, maybe I need to spend a little more time with her. It's kind of lonely being isolated from your family. So
we could potentially even have red staters spend a little bit of time in the world of blue staters and vice versa. Can you imagine?
Republicans
and Democrats began developing empathy for one another.
That would be an awesome thing. It would be so great.
Who knows what might result from that?
You're just talking crazy now, Phil.
I'm talking crazy. And we have to move on because there's more end of the world before we get to going to Mars, and we got a lot to cover here. So our next story is called Panarchy 101, A Primer. And I don't know if you got a chance to read this one, Stephen, but again, this one isn't quite the end of the world. This is talking about how we can maybe turn collapse to our advantage. Did you get a chance to take a look at this?
And I really didn't dig deeply into this, Bill. So break it down for me a little bit.
Okay, so basically, the author says that you've got kind of a three-staged approach to collapse. You're going to have the failure portion, which, you know, when some big problem of human civilization becomes overwhelming and suddenly the major function that we're talking about, whatever that is, doesn't work anymore. Then you've got emergence, where the demand for new innovation arises. Hopefully it arises before the total failure occurs, but it could be that it really becomes imminent, pronounced as the failure is occurring. And then coherence, which is when the new solutions really start to take hold and you move on to the next thing. So the idea is that we worry a lot about collapse, but maybe collapse is the thing that we need to have happen because it's going to drive the innovation that will allow us to get to the next stage. And as I was reading this, it reminded me of one of the topics we come back to all the time, which is this: what's going to happen next with the economy if automation means that effectively employment as we have known it no longer exists. I feel that potentially this panarchy model is one that we can learn from when thinking about that particular collapse, because all kinds of chaos is, you know, not, I won't say likely, but potentially can ensue when employment ceases to exist as a real thing. And if we've got a model that says, okay, but we're gonna work from failure to the emergence of new solutions to making those coherent. I mean, I wish we were getting a lot more serious about emerging those new solutions now, because I don't know how far we are from
Well, you know, the danger will be it'll happen overnight, or you know, it will seem like it'll happen overnight. Think about how quickly, Phil, we as a society adapted cell phones. You know, I mean,
right.
Compared to other things that had been adapted, it happened quickly. As soon as it was available, you know, we did it. So you can imagine businesses, as soon as a model is available for more fully automating their businesses so they can make more money, they will do it quickly. And you know, let's imagine McDonald's does it. You know, how long do you think Burger King and Wendy's would hold out before they do it too? I mean, it'll happen overnight. And so the risk is the reaction, the political reaction of those events could be an underreaction where, you know, we don't deal with it, or we overreact and create a problem. So I agree with you completely. These problems need to be thought about now, so that when time does come to act, that we will have thought about it some, and perhaps have a better chance of, you know, reacting to the right level, you know, put in place the right policies to get us through that.
Exactly. So I think as a model, this is a good one. It's, you know, like the first story we talked about, when we talk about the problem that's being addressed, it wasn't really the end of humanity, but it's the end of humanity in quotes, right? You know, our humanness. This panarchy approach, I think, is good for addressing the collapse of the economy, the collapse of the social fabric. In fact, it might be a good model to go through when we talk about the emergence of a non-empathetic culture, right? It's like, that's a problem.
Yeah.
That's a collapse. How do we address that? But you know what? You can't really use this one to deal with the meteor hitting, right? Or the aliens invading, or whatever the big extinction level event might be. And so let's shift gears and talk about those kinds of problems. And we've got this story, How to Survive a Mass Extinction Event. So I'm all for that. You know, I believe this was linked over on Facebook, and Michael Darling left a comment. He said, would a helmet help?
I guess, Michael, it would depend on what the extinction level event was. If it's,
yeah, exactly.
It just might. It just might.
I don't see
anyway.
How it could hurt. Okay, I don't see how it could hurt. But go ahead, Stephen. Tell us about how do we survive in a mass extinction event? What do we do?
Well, there's a study that was done about this particular creature that lived 252 million years ago at the time of the last major extinction level crisis. Basically, it's the Permo-Triassic extinction, and this creature was a Lystrosaurus, is what they call it, and it was about the size of a hippopotamus. It was a large creature, as is typical with larger creatures, they live a longer period of time. It takes them longer to get from birth through the, you know, to sexual maturation, and then to have children, you know, have babies, and then die. Right? Larger creatures just take longer to do that. Well, after when the pressure started being put on the environment, and many other creatures were going extinct, many other animals were going extinct. This particular animal, the response was they found interesting. It reduced its size. And of course, over generations, you know, this wasn't just overnight. It decided, I think I'll be small. No, it became a an adaptation that was beneficial to be smaller. And so over the course of many generations, it became, went from the size of a hippo down to the size of a dog.
Wow.
With it, it reached sexual maturation much, much quicker and had much larger groups of babies.
Offspring.
Okay,
mm-hmm. Yep.
Offspring. And so of course that means that if you have a litter instead of one, you know, a typical cow when it gives birth to one calf, but a dog gives birth to a litter, right?
Exactly. And so if
it moves from a large creature to a small creature, it's putting out a lot of offspring. Then only two or three of any particular litter has to survive to sexual maturation in order to pass on and survive. And so that's what that particular creature did. And they does this have any bearing on us and our survival, Phil? I would say that being flexible, I guess, is a big part of survival when times are tough.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, you know, that is actually one trait of humanity that that is quite remarkable. We live, you know, well within the Arctic Circle. We live on the, you know, at the equator, and we live everywhere in between. Right? We can adapt ourselves because we are our intelligence and our and other various things about us, including our amazing hands, allow us to adapt our environments and adapt ourselves to our environments to be really the most flexible creature on the planet. And
yeah,
so,
I mean, we can't, with our hands, make ourselves smaller. But, you know, as we were talking about on Monday, if the technology to make us live longer is within our grasp, then certainly there are other modifications we could make to ourselves to make us more adaptable and more survivable. In addition to, I think, which is what you're getting at, which is just our innate ability to create technology to adapt to our surroundings, to, you know, to build shelters or whatever it is that we have to do to live differently than we have lived in order to survive. I mean, we're nothing if not adaptable, right?
That's right. That's really one of the defining characteristics. You know, we're tool makers, and that's one thing that's often been said about us. But why do we make tools? We are trying to adapt the environment to suit ourselves, or to do something that we couldn't do with just our bodies, right? So,
right.
We need to adapt.
We need to adapt to avoid a mass extinction event. But how likely is that, really? Right? And that takes us to our next story. Are we really all that likely to face a human-level extinction event? And, gosh, here's a great headline over from The Atlantic. Human extinction isn't that unlikely. And they have this incredibly bold, audacious statement that a typical person is more than five times as likely to die in an extinction event as in a car crash, says a new report. And I gotta revise what I said earlier. That was actually the one that Michael said, would a helmet help? And
yeah.
My response was maybe for the car crash. I'm not so sure about the extinction event. And you know, there you go. A typical person is more than five times as likely to die in an extinction event as in a car crash. Well, okay, I read that and I go, get out of here. And
yeah.
Immediately I think, okay, this headline is just link bait, and this analysis is just clickbait, right? They're just being provocative, but they can't really make a case for that to be the case. But do they, in fact, make a case for this?
Well, they do make the case. It's this is not an instance of the headline overselling what the story says. The story does say what the headline is saying here, that you are five times more likely to die from an extinction-level event than a car crash. But here's the problem with that. And by the way, this is the UK-based Global Challenges Foundation putting out this study or these numbers. But you know, they give the reasons here. It's they estimate based on the numbers they put in to their, you know, their equation here, they come out with a 9.5% chance of human extinction within the next 100 years. Here's the only problem with that. Humans have never gone extinct before, so we don't know what the risks are of us going extinct in the next 100 years either. I would guess that the chances are, you know, are greater that we'll do it in the next 100 years than, you know, than even the last 1,000 years. So because technology is rolling out at such a rate that our power to do good and evil is increased. So I think our chances of wiping ourselves out in the next 100 years is greater, but that 9.5% is that's pretty huge, and I think it just depends on what numbers you put into the model.
Yeah, so they say there's a 9.5% chance that we'll go extinct over the next century, and the individual's chance of dying in a car wreck are less than that.
therefore, five times less than that.
There's a much greater chance of going extinct. Well, on the one hand, I have to say that I think overestimating the likelihood of extinction-level events is probably a good idea, that we should probably take those threats extremely seriously, and we should overestimate how likely they are to occur, simply because that gives us all the more reason to prepare for those, to see if we can't prevent them somehow and avoid them. But I have to agree. I think they've inflated the numbers ridiculously. Because, are we just now coming to that point where it's a 9% chance? Because if so, humanity shouldn't still be here, right? If it's 9% every century, 2,000 years ago, right? We've gone through 20 centuries since then with a 10% chance every year. We should have already gone extinct just in the last two millennia. Chances are we would have.
A friend of the show, I believe it's Eliezer Yudkowsky, stated that what do you call it? It's related to mad scientists. What is this theory?
Moore's Law for Mad Scientists. Yeah.
That's right. Moore's Law for Mad Scientists, meaning that every 18 months, the IQ required to wipe out the world goes down a point or something. You know.
Oh, right. Okay. So what you're saying is that it's more likely that we'll go extinct now. Those numbers are inflated because of the things people can do.
That's right. Technology is empowering people to do things. And one of the things that empowers people to do is to wipe all of us out.
In the world. Well, that's
the
downside of being capable, isn't it?
That's
the downside
right.
of how empowering technology is. I still think their numbers are grossly overinflated. But let's say they're right. We got a 10% chance of going extinct in the next century. Stephen, what do we do? Where do we go?
Well, I think we need to do what Stephen Hawking has suggested and get all of our eggs out of one basket and at least into one other basket. And let's get our ass to Mars, right?
Let's do it. All right. But
as a little Schwarzenegger thrown in there. But anyway, that's the idea, right? And so, Mars is the closest likely place that we could actually set up a colony. There is some hope for Venus, by the way. We can talk about that. But Mars is what we want to talk about tonight. Phil, and there's some actual news in this.
Big news, right? Very recent news. Just this past Wednesday, SpaceX posted two photos on Twitter announcing plans to send a Red Dragon space capsule to Mars as soon as 2018. And this is big news for a couple reasons. One, it's talk about audacious. Here's a private company saying we're going to Mars. Is that NASA's timeline? Doesn't matter. With or without NASA, SpaceX is going to Mars. And they're planning on heading that direction starting in 2018. So that's huge. And in fact, the way this is characterized in the story we've got linked here from Motley Fool is that they've changed the world with one tweet. Well, I don't know that the tweet changes the world, but if they back up what they're saying they're going to do, it definitely does change the world.
Right.
Does it not?
Now, and I get the impression that what they're saying is by 2018, they're going to set a capsule down on Mars. Now, unmanned, almost certainly, right?
Yeah, it's the beginning of going to Mars, yes.
That's right. And so this is, it's going to demonstrate their capability of putting real hardware on the red planet, and that's a big deal. I would say it's comparable to what NASA did with that last rover that was roughly the size of an SUV. that was put on Mars. That's, you know, that is the time, you know, if you put a capsule on Mars, a full-size Dragon capsule on Mars is about the same level of difficulty, I think.
There you go. So how far out do you think we are from, and I haven't read the story all the way, but if we get the unmanned capsule to Mars in 2018, how long before we're, you know, really in the Mars business from Elon Musk's view?
I think, you know, we would begin setting up infrastructure. Last week, Phil, I believe we talked about how there's at least one graduate student working on how we grow food on Mars. And,
right, that's right.
You know, various hydroponic systems and things like that. So there's people working on those issues. And you know, I think that's part of what you do when you begin looking to Mars is, you know, you send capsules that have some of the infrastructure you would need for things like that, and so that you could begin building shelters and you know, growing food and within a habitat and things like that. That's what you do. And I would guess that we would probably do a flyby with a manned flyby of Mars before we actually put people down on the surface. It's just easier to send a capsule flying by first. We did that with Apollo 10 in the moon. We flew by at least that one time before landing with Apollo 11, right? So,
that's right.
So
Apollo 8 actually that did the flyby.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it seemed like Apollo 10 we did a flyby too. We didn't set down with 10 either. So maybe 8 was the first, and maybe we had a couple flybys with the moon.
Probably.
I suspect that we had that we'll do at least one flyby before we sat down, and then you know, I'm thinking that it might be a good idea to have you know, spacecraft in orbit around Mars before you send actual people. And Elon Musk has said himself that the idea is that the first people to go to Mars would go with the idea it's a one-way trip. So
right.
It's a hard thing to get to Mars, and not an easy thing. And so, you know, it's not a trip you just take and think about turning around real easily. So I think that's exactly right. You'd send and perhaps you would send older people, you know, that are in good shape, but that are older people that could contribute to the work there, but would not, you know, would be past their childbearing years and things like that, so that. They're not leaving families behind permanently, things like that.
Maybe, or maybe you want to send people who are going to have some kids, and let's get the ball rolling here, huh? If you want to,
maybe so.
Not put our eggs in one basket. Let's start birthing some Martians. You know, that would be the more ambitious approach, I guess. And if you look at the New Frontier, I mean, that's immediately how I start thinking. It's like, yeah, let's get some people up there. It is a one-way trip for those who go, and yet. I don't think there would be any shortage of qualified volunteers. I bet for as large a mission as SpaceX wants to put together, they will find people who want to go to Mars and who don't mind going on a one-way mission and who are ready to go live on another planet and get humanity going in that direction. You know, who's going to be the first permanent resident of Mars? We don't know. First child born on Mars, something to look forward to. And if you want to look forward to even more, we've got a link here to a story about terraforming Mars. That's more long-term, but we start talking about what are the big things we could do over the course of a century or more in terms to make, in an effort to make Mars more livable. There's water on Mars that can be exploited. There is CO2 that can be released into the atmosphere that can warm up Mars. There are ways of getting oxygen in the atmosphere. And, you know, at that point, you start to turn Mars into a viable Earth alternative, and then, heaven forbid, the terrible extinction-level event occurs on Earth in terms of a, you know, big meteor or whatever it is, and we've got Earth Junior over there in the form of Mars with people living on it, a habitable planet, and life goes on.
And they have the ability to come back and reseed the Earth if need be, you know?
If need be, that's right.
Yeah.
So it's you know, it's a broad vision, it's a huge vision, and I'm pretty excited about it. I look forward to seeing it. And with that, Stephen, we are, can you believe it, completely out of time.
These 30-minute shows go fast, but enjoy it.
They sure do. Well, it's fun talking about this. Look forward to talking with you again on Friday. Thank you all for being with us. And until next time, live to see it.